It is Saturday, December 24th, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz. Well, at least I should say I'm broadcasting live from Santa Cruz. I'm joined via Skype by two other geeks who are in Southern California. And it's time now, of course, for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Thank you so much for the theme. If you'd like to participate on Geek Speak, which is a Creative Commons endeavor, share and share alike, you're welcome to do so. Send us some content and we'll put it on air. In the second half of the show, we will not be taking your calls. We're going to take an entire Geek Talk week because Rick is off. And joining me from Southern California are Alex Slias and Ben Jaffe. Good morning, geeks.
Hey, good morning.
So welcome, Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy and instructor, and Alex Slias, an application security analyst. Hi, guys.
Hey, yeah.
Good to be here.
So let's go ahead and start off. Ben, I'm kind of curious, where have you been?
I've been kind of all over the world, actually. I spent a lot of time in Europe. In Ireland, Germany, and Belgium, I spent a good month there visiting friends and just kind of, I got the Irish lilt down a little bit, but I'm a bit too embarrassed to try it on live radio. I don't know. But I also just went on a cruise with 31 of my extended family relatives, and it was all kinds of madness. But I was thinking about how cool it is, like, to design a cruise ship. I mean, they're humongous, but you have all of these things that you have to deal with, like things that I'm sure I can't even probably begin to understand, but also even just things like weight distribution, you know, to make something that big float in the water.
Yeah, it's
pretty cool.
Yeah, shipbuilding, definitely very geeky.
Yeah, so I was just kind of wondering, like, how one would get into that and how they would land a contract to build a several million-dollar cruise ship. I don't know. It's kind of madness. And then the other thing is I have a number of family members here, and it struck me this morning how many of us are geeks, actually. I feel quite lucky. So I wrote a little list of all the different kinds of geeks that we have in the house right now. So we have two electrical engineering geeks, one mechanical engineering and car geek, 2.5 music geeks, we'll say. We've got a serious hardcore D&D geek. We've got web development front end geek, back end geek, a cycling geek, and a knitting geek. It's it's pretty insane.
Which one are you?
So I kind of split. I kind of split into a couple different geeks, I think. I would call myself a music geek, like the music theory and everything. Mm-hmm. And then web development front end. That's me.
I'll go with that. I kind of feel like I should invite some of your family members on. I mean, I'd love to talk about D&D for the next hour. I haven't played D&D
well,
in a while.
Unfortunately, the D&D geek is currently fast asleep. Up too late. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben, for keeping us abreast of your geeky family. I'm assuming that all of them are in town for the holidays.
All of them but my sister. So we're missing my sister. However, my brother's girlfriend is also named Emily. So we do have
Emily
set.
Exactly. We got a replacement.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Ben, you're in Southern California, correct?
Yeah, I'm in San Diego right now. And I'll be back up probably for next week's show in Santa Cruz.
Great. And Alex, you also in Southern California. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm down in Orange County right now.
So tell me, what's up with 2012? What's going to be exciting?
Well, one thing I came across was a little article about it was discussing like the tablets. You know, what's going on with tablets right now? The iPad pretty much dominates. I mean, everyone.
Yeah.
You know, everyone who has a tablet that anybody even thinks to look at, it's pretty much an iPad. But there's a lot of talk about 2012 being the year that the Android tablet kind of takes foot, much like we saw a huge spike in all the Android phones and how much they've really taken a huge market share away from Apple and the iPhone. Mm-hmm. They're expecting to see something similar occur with the tablet market next year, which largely is driven because you have a lot more competition in the hardware. So you see a lot of different hardware vendors trying to one up each other for what features are there and included, but all using the Android operating system. Right. So you don't really see that kind of competition with Apple because it's just Apple.
So we're going to test free market kind of space, see how much they can improve upon each other and compete.
Right, and in the end, Apple still has to compete with that whole market. So hopefully that'll be good for improvements for people who do like the iPad and enjoy what they have invested into it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks, Alex. I'll be looking to it. I currently deal with an iPad. In fact, last week's show, I ran off of an iPad completely. Didn't work so well, but I would love to get my hands on another tablet. If I didn't have the income I'd have, I would definitely be playing with more of the tablets. And Ben, you're still happy with your Android phone?
Yeah, I have a Galaxy. Or I'm sorry, I have a Nexus One. So way back in the day, I mean that's a
it's equivalent
dinosaur,
to the first iPhone,
what, 2 years ago or something.
Sure. Well,
But I do have to say, I saw my sister Emily got a Galaxy Nexus. Is that's the most recent one, right? I'm getting all the Nexus names confused. But the Galaxy Nexus, oh my gosh, it's beautiful. And it's running Ice Cream Sandwich, which is the latest version of the Android operating system. And I think I agree with you, Alex, that that 2012 will be the year of the Android tablet.
They definitely name them better than the iPhone does, right?
Yeah.
iOS 5 versus... What do you say? Ice cream sandwich?
I mean, ice cream sandwich.
How can
ICS,
you compete?
Yeah.
Last week, and actually for the last 3 weeks or so, we've been mentioning SOPA, this really nasty, horrible bill that I think I ranted pretty severely last week, so much so that I went, wait, am I getting into that talking head space of large media, and am I not being intelligent in what I'm saying? I'm just ranting. And it definitely felt that way because it's so appalling to me. And one of the things that I forgot to mention enough, because people called in, was how do you do anything about this, right? So the way you stop SOPA, and we'll talk a second about what the status is, right? But you go to AmericanCensorship.org. AmericanCensorship.org's website that kind of leads you into how to voice your opinion. I went ahead and used it and contacted my rep and was told that she actually is one of the leaders in stopping that bill. So my voice was heard, but not important in that sense. But if you haven't done so, you can still go to AmericanCensorship.org and voice your opinion because the SOPA bill has been delayed, I'm assuming, till next year. Ben, you have some more information on that?
Yeah, I would definitely suggest doing that. The latest in that, just in terms of companies that support SOPA, it doesn't make very much sense for anyone who whose business relies on the internet and internet people to be for SOPA. But it turns out GoDaddy, which is one of the largest domain registrars, which are the when you go to like www.google.com, they're the company that takes google.com and points you to the correct server, right? So GoDaddy is a pretty huge registrar.
Just to be clear, Google does not use GoDaddy. GoDaddy does a service like that, a domain name service provider. Go on.
Yeah. But Wikipedia used GoDaddy, or I'll say uses GoDaddy. But GoDaddy was saying that they support SOPA, which doesn't make any sense. It was quite appalling to the internet. I'll just speak of the crowd of people on the internet as the internet. So one of the websites that was pretty big in this, first I'll tell you what that this is. This is that GoDaddy is no longer supporting SOPA because various websites, especially a website called Reddit, which is an online community, started basically a boycott of GoDaddy. GoDaddy has been implicated in a number of different deceptive marketing practices and deceptive, just weird practices in general in the past. And a lot of people don't like GoDaddy, but they do have some of the cheapest prices on the internet.
Sure.
So that's probably why Wikipedia was on GoDaddy and a couple other things.
Since you've said GoDaddy about 30 times, but we don't actually like that company, let's go ahead and suggest some other alternatives so that people know where to go.
Yeah.
I like to promote and sometimes send my clients off to a company called Bluehost. Cruise.io locally is an internet service provider, which also does hosting services, Cruise.io. And I think they underwrite our show sometimes. Bluehost, Creuzeo. Alex, who do you use?
For DNS specifically or for hosting?
For both. DNS.
For DNS, I actually do use GoDaddy just because I had so many on there. I'm like, I'm just sticking with it. Don't feel like migrating all my domains. And then for hosting, I think I currently use Alchemy. They're based in Los Angeles for my dedicated server.
And Ben, you said something about free speech?
Is it nearlyfreespeech.net? They're pretty fantastic. They definitely do not support SOPA, and they've been kind of on the forefront of bashing down some of the more horrible things on the internet as far as legislation and censorship and things like that. They'll fight for you if someone wants to take your domain off the internet.
And two other ISPs that I'll recommend, or two other domain name service providers that I'll recommend because I use them personally, gkg.net. They seem to be pretty good. They actually host geekspeak.org's DNS, or I should say they're the root server for geekspeak.org. And then I also use Domain Discover. Now, both the ones I'm mentioning actually have good user-end agreements. It's actually really important. When you register a domain, take my Troxel.com domain, that domain to me is extremely important, and I want to pass it on to my kids because it's our name. It's kind of a cool thing to have. And so I want to make sure that the provider that's actually holding onto that name and making sure it keeps track of it and all those things and does the service that I need isn't going to take it from me for some reason. And some of the less reputable companies in their policy agreements say that they actually own the domain and they could actually redistribute it some other way if they chose. So that's one of the reasons why I stay away from something like GoDaddy, though I do have clients on GoDaddy. So it's not uncommon, but I would recommend something else. Now, since we're talking about domain names and...
Oh, yeah, I got one more thing on this topic. The end of the story is that Wikipedia will be leaving GoDaddy, which is pretty big. That's pretty fantastic. And also one other website I want to just throw out there. They don't actually register the domains, but they do help you figure out what like a good domain name for your business or whatever. I've used them extensively. Is Bust a Name, and I'll put that on the GeekSpeak server, so you can go to our website and get it. And it's a pretty comprehensive tool for domain searching. They do partner with GoDaddy, so I would suggest just not going with GoDaddy and using it to find the domains that you want.
Yeah, one thing also to be careful with hosting companies that do the domain name registration for you, a lot of them will actually register domains on your behalf, but they get registered to the hosting company themselves, which kind of locks you into being with them. So be careful about that, looking at how hosting companies, if you're going to do the registration through them, how they register that, and that you are the actual registrar, that you have control over the domain.
Yeah, the domain name actually puts into a registrar name, and that name is kind of a business name or a personal name, and that name actually does own the domain and can request a transfer to another domain service provider. And if they put in their own name, it's not like you own it. You're just using their domain, which is not good because you've paid for it. It makes sense to own it.
Yeah, and that extends to even if you're having some developer create a website for you, make sure that when they're registering the domain, it's in your name, not theirs. Right. I've seen that happen too.
And in the domain registrar information, there's like four different fields of management. One of them is owner. Make sure that you own that. Then there's a billing administrator, billing contact and technical contact. The technical contact you can go ahead and give to your webmaster. You can put them on it. Then they can do things on your behalf. They can't transfer away from you. They can't change. They can't take it away from your name. But they can do things like point to new domain name servers, which is really essential when you're dealing with web development. So this is an interesting sideline into a problem that GeekSpeak's been having the last week. We have been on a Blade server hosted by an ISP in San Jose, and we've had it as a gift for us for years. It's about an $1,800 service a month, and we've been getting it for free because they have liked our show. The company was sold a couple times, and we've kind of propagated through. And this last week, our network card on the machine, now we didn't know what the problem was with the machine. The machine just went offline. All our email, our GeekSpeak was not available. And it went offline. And after calling the tech support, they have amazingly good responsive tech support. They started diagnosing the problem. And after about a day, they realized what was happening. They replaced hard drives, replaced a whole bunch of stuff. It was actually the network card in the server. So a piece of hardware failed on the machine. They were able to transfer all the content to a new Blade. These parts, of course, are all just very forgivable. You just take one and put it into another machine and do some configuration. And while doing configuration of that machine, they needed to install drivers, so they used the root password. But the administrator that was dealing with the machine, working on it, not us, decided that the password that was actually like a randomly generated 15 or 18-digit code for root, which I knew and also the ISP knew in case they needed to do something when I wasn't around. a root password, which, by the way, I never use. He was having difficulty remembering it and such, so he changed it to password 123.
And
it was left that way for a day. I didn't know that he'd modified the password. And during that time, and I believe an automated system, pwned the machine. They found that they could log in and started installing a rootkit. And the reason I knew that something was bad after it came up, after a day after it had been down, is all of a sudden I start getting messages on the contact page at geekspeak.org that says, hey, you're scanning my machine for open ports. Why?
Is that what that was about?
Yeah, yeah. So as soon as I saw the scanning machine for open ports, I went, wait a second, what's going on? And I went in to try to log in. Now, the password I was using for that machine, I entered it in. It didn't work. It denied me. And as soon as that happened, I knew that something serious had happened to the machine. It wasn't like some strange anomaly was occurring or somebody was falsifying IP packets or something like that. I knew that there was something wrong with the machine because all of a sudden I wasn't able to log into it. And soon as you lose control of a machine like that, you have to assume that everything on it is up in the air and available, right? Anybody can access. So I was thinking, well, it used to be that I used all my email on that server, which means all copies of my emails for a few years were installed on that server. Had I ever emailed a password to me, you know, had I ever put an email in a password field, had I ever modified something on my server for some reason and the database entry password that was in clear text was available, all of a sudden I had to assume that any password that I didn't consider extremely safe, like I'm very careful with, like my passwords I use for my banking accounts, any of the other passwords, there could be somebody else that knew it. So I went on went and changed my passwords. And in doing that, looked at really bad, there's some really bad password policies out there, you know, like Facebook and stuff. They're ridiculous. Like I'm doing current day understanding is the longer the password, the better. You know, make sure to put a couple characters, but go ahead and put spaces in it because if you remember something better by putting spaces in it, do that, you know. So we can get into passwords at some other point, but I realized that all these sites that I use and such, and it's been a time. I need to change passwords on some of these sites. And I still feel like one of my accounts is probably going to get taken. So in any case, I got a little upset about it. I didn't really voice the concern to the ISP that this was a serious problem. I talked to the admin that did it, and he seemed to think that maybe the machine was already under breach. I don't think so, because after he changed the password, then all of the root accounts, the accounts that had root access, my account, Alex's account, Miles's account, Ben's account, they were all deleted from the machine. And to me, that seemed like a tactic to lock down the machine and make it more only theirs, right?
Yep.
So I think it was triggered by this password choice of this administrator. And of course, what was it doing? It was scanning other networks for open SSH connections that it could then try to log in as root, right? It is the thing that we saw go on there. At first, I thought it was actually a human being, but I was a little scared. Because a smart hacker in your machine, you really can't do anything about. Like, it's extremely difficult to battle someone on a server. And so when I realized that it started, one of the things it did is started scanning for open ports and trying to log in, I realized, you know what? This machine probably called home after it made a connection, but I don't know if anyone's connected to it. So I'm feeling like the machine is safe. Alex, what do you think? You went on there last night. What do you think?
I mean, it could be. I honestly don't know. I mean, have to dig into it and see what the real symptoms were and look at the files. I mean, one thing I'd say is whenever we get things stable where we truly feel like it's safe, mm-hmm. Go through and at least take a snapshot of all the files in the system in the MD5 or run Tripwire or something like that, so that you can actually keep track of the files in the file system. And so if some weird files pop up somewhere, it's really easy to identify them.
Yeah, yeah, that's an important way to do it. And of course, the other thing is, you know, this is a CentOS machine, so you do a yum update regularly to make sure that you've got the most up-to-date packages. And that changes a lot of things on the file system. So you have to do that snapshot every time you've done an update so that you have the most recent look. And of course, keep that snapshot on a different machine. You know, what Alex is saying is an MD5 of it is, you go through the file system, and every single file you do an MD5. It's a way of hashing a large chunk of data and get a unique number. And then you take that giant list of files and unique numbers back on your own machine. And then later, if you're concerned, you do a comparison between what is currently there and what you have on your local machine. And you know that if anything's changed, it would show up. And of course, you'd see the database files change. You'd see the new images on the GeekSpeak site be there. But you wouldn't see something in like an application space be modified. And if you did, you'd know that there's an intruder on the machine.
Right, and the advantage of the MD5 or any sort of hashing algorithm is that you could take a file. If I were to change a file, most people would look, oh, what's the timestamp? Well, that's changeable, so that you can't trust that. Or what's the file size? Well, that can be controlled, so that's can't trust that. But the MD5 goes through all the data of the file and comes up with a unique, well, semi-unique number based on that, and that kind of at least makes it much harder to replace or change a file and
pretty
not
much,
be detected.
Pretty much impossible, especially if you look at the size as well. It's extremely hard to make the same size file be functional, actually do something in two different versions with have two different content. It's almost impossible to do that. So that's a good way to do it, snapshot. We didn't have more local snapshots. We, one of the things about current day server administration is that you run the application space and then you run the file server space. And the file server space really should be completely portable. You should be able to take those files out and put them somewhere else. Happens to be that to set up a machine like GeekSpeak, where we have, there's probably 12 domains on it, there's email, there's all this DNS entry stuff, that whole system is actually a lot of configuration. And that configuration is not transferable easily, right? You can kind of move it over. Last time I think I moved the GeekSpeak content over to a new server, probably took me a span of like 3 days to do the migration. Of course, I don't do this professionally. Oh, I kind of do, but what I wanted to also mention, of course, is that the hosting provider, when tech support started working for 2.5 days on us, kind of said, you used to know the CEO of the company, but he sold this company 3 years ago and you haven't been paying us. And hey, you want to start paying us? And I said, oh, that'd be nice, but I don't make any money on GeekSpeak. So no. So now I've been looking for a new ISP for GeekSpeak. And I want to invite our listeners, in our live listeners, who I'm sure there's thousands of people listening today live on Christmas Eve to a talk show about server maintenance. but I'm sure that there's some podcast listeners also that might listen to it on Monday or Tuesday or so over the weekend, after the weekend. And if you run an ISP and you want to host us, we do about 200 gigabytes of transfers per month, data transfer. We currently have about 75 gigabytes of storage on our server. I think that can get cut down a lot. I think we've got a lot of old cruft. The big bandwidth feed from our machine, from our site, is actually our podcast. But NPR actually takes that bandwidth, right? So if you listen to the podcast regularly, you'll notice that in the beginning there's an NPR mention and normally an underwriting. And what happens is I put up a secret podcast feed on our GeekSpeak server, and then NPR does a scrape of that every day, copies over their system, adds a underwriting in the front of it. That little bit of revenue that comes, which is not very much, goes back, it gets shared between NPR and KUSP. And the benefit of that, of course, is that I don't have to do this giant bandwidth feed of our podcast, because it is quite a bit big of a load. So we're at about 200 gigabytes of transfer per month, about 60 to 70 gigabytes of storage. If you want to provide that to GeekSpeak, that'd be great. And at the beginning of the podcast, I can mention the name of your company every week on the podcast.
Hey, Lyle, real quick also, yeah. I mean, for the site, I know we're not like the most highly, high bandwidth site, but what kind of requirements are we looking at needing? Is shared hosting a option? Does a virtual server work, or do we need a dedicated server?
We've had a dedicated hardware blade, which has been really cool because we can do anything we want. When my son got into Minecraft, I went ahead and popped up a server and thought, I should put this up to the public. And then, of course, I was like, well, I don't know if I want to handle the bandwidth. But the general idea is that anytime we hear about some story, oh, there's a free flash media server that seems to work pretty well, I can try it, right? So it's kind of nice to have that very geeky ability of having your own hardware. But it's expensive to do your own hardware, and there's problems with it. So I think I want to go to a VPS, a virtual, what does that stand for?
VM, virtual machine.
Virtual machine, which basically means that there's a slice of space on some hardware cloud somewhere. It's kind of like cloud computing, if you will. And we have complete control of the operating system all the way down, root command, everything. But there's actually no hardware associated with the box. And I'm either leaning towards that, but the other thing, of course, is that if I did go to like a hosting provider, like a straight up simple host, and I had to conform to their tool set, I wouldn't have to do as much system administration work. So it's one of those things of balancing, do I want to be better at system administration and learn more, which I think is important in the sense of doing what I do in GeekSpeak and also my personal job, or do I want to make it really simple for myself? And of course, simpler is also going to be a cheaper solution. I can get a $8 a month thing that could probably handle all of our needs. Our server wouldn't be as fast, but we don't have a lot of web traffic. We're mostly a portal for people to find the podcast.
Yeah, so I'd say we would probably, our minimum need would be at least a virtual machine or, you know, VPS of some sort.
Yeah, I think so.
So, which is nice also, because I mean, even as a, even with a virtual private server, it's not a real, you know, dedicated piece of hardware. But once you're in there, I mean, like the operating system gets installed in this virtual machine as if it is a, its own computer. You still have root access. You still control the system.
And I've been looking at Linode.com, Linode, and their Linux node. And they're kind of a big company now. They're really promoting. They do, you know, exactly what we'd want, basically. And, you know, it's not that expensive. I'm thinking about going with them and actually just paying a monthly fee out of my personal pocket. And the reason is that they got this great, one of the things they do is you can create multiple server distros that you package up and then can launch and stop, start and stop, right? So I can go ahead and create my virtual on my local machine, you know, install my CentOS or what have you, maybe Ubuntu, on my local machine in a virtual, get everything running, the database, everything, right? Then shut it down, upload that file to the server, and then start it up. So there's you know, there's something kind of clever and nice about that. And the upload speed to them is unlimited, right? The upload content to them is unlimited.
Right. Very virtual appliance kind of environment.
Yeah. So if you're interested in this kind of stuff and you listen to GeekSpeak and want to help us out or participate of some sort, please do drop us a line. GeekSpeak.org is up right now. Don't send any passwords through it. I can't guarantee that they're safe. But definitely you can get in contact with us. And, of course, you can find out more from us by, you know, going to GeekSpeak's site and searching around. And I'm available online. If you look at Troxel in a Google search, you'll get me. I'm Lyle Troxel. Alex Lees is also on the phone, and Ben Jaffe. We are doing GeekSpeak as we do every week for over 11 years now. And GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information is at RamirezDDS.com. Ben, Ben or Alex, do you have a geek bit for today?
I most certainly do. Comet Lovejoy has been in the news lately. There have been some amazing pictures of it. I just found this beautiful one. It's the head of the comet is right at the horizon and its tail is shooting up into the sky. It looks kind of like a geyser or something, like Old Faithful. But I noticed something. There's an observatory on the right side of the image and there's a laser shooting out of the observatory. And I started wondering what that laser is all about. Do either of you know what it is?
Well, they have to keep powering the comet so they keep moving, right? No, I don't know.
Well, just to clarify, the observatory is pointing up at the night sky, not where the comet is.
Hmm.
Any thoughts?
I'm going to go with, I just think that it might be location-based to give telemetry to another observatory. But
well, yeah, know. No. So here, this really blew my mind. What actually happens is when you're an Earth-based telescope, something you have to contend with is the atmosphere.
Sure.
The atmosphere kind of acts like an ever-changing lens, and it distorts the night sky. And we don't notice that because we're not looking in exquisite detail until we look through telescopes. So what they do is they actually have a laser shooting into the sky, which excites atoms in the very, very upper atmosphere, creating a fake star. And then because they know exactly where that star is, because they're creating it, they can watch that star, figure out the ways it moves, and then thereby figuring out what the atmosphere is doing.
I'm not on my game today. I should have known that answer. That's really good.
It's so cool.
So what they do then is also, so digitally afterwards, they can take out the effects of atmospheric conditions that they're seeing because they have that information. They subtract the noise, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool.
Or the distortion, rather.
Cool. And we're talking about kind of the same type of thing. If you have a hot cup of tea and you look right over the surface, you can see the air above it move. Or a stove, like a hot wood stove, the top sheet of that's really hot. If you look over it, you'll see that you can see something move, right? The background image gets modified. That's happening all the time in our atmosphere. So when you look at the stars, the reason why they twinkle, the twinkling star effect, is actually that atmospheric condition. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get a clear shot to the star, sometimes it gets wavered away, and that effect of lightning and darkening you see as a twinkle. And so what they're doing is they're just looking at that in high detail, figuring out exactly what that effect looked like, that distortion, and subtracting it from their data that they're using. Very cool.
So I have another piece of trivia. Do you know why stars twinkle and planets do not?
Size?
Exactly.
Yeah, relative brightness.
So far away. They're really, really bright, but they're almost infinitesimal in size, right. And so they can totally be swept away by the atmospheric conditions. Whereas the planets, they're pretty far away, but they're actually a little bit wider.
Right. The little bit distortion that you see is averaged out, and you still see the entire moon or the larger planet. But the very, very small point, when it deviates a little bit, you just don't see it. It gets darker.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
So I'm going to post the most epic picture of an observatory shooting a laser into a sky. It kind of looks like if you've ever seen Star Trek 7, when they modify the main deflector and shoot it into the Nexus, it looks exactly like that. So those Star Trek geeks of you out there who have seen that, you'll know what I'm talking about when you see this picture.
Geekspeak on KSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruise.io.com. Alex, you were going to say?
I was just going to say one kind of thing to look at in terms of how that twinkle effect works is imagine you have like a big, huge, you know, floodlight or some sort of big lamp. You know, you take your finger and you wave your finger in front of it. It barely puts a little shadow. But say you have a little tiny pin, you know, little LED light or a laser, and you put your finger in front of it, there's a point in which you cover it entirely, more of the light that comes from that. Very cool. That would be more of a twinkle because that whole light would seem to dim a lot more than the big light that you put your finger in front of.
Even if they're the same brightness.
Right.
Okay, so we're almost at 2012. We're hoping that 2012 we're going to have jetpacks and flying cars because it'll be the future. But when we get there, it won't be the future, and therefore we won't have those things, which is very frustrating. But
I can see an article where we already have jetpacks, but...
Okay, until I close my, you know, my jetpack closet doors at night and think, I own a jetpack, I don't believe that they really exist. But Alex, we do have potential other power sources, which are always exciting. Can you tell me what's going on in the fuel cell space?
Well, recently there was an article I came across where... Apple has actually filed a patent for MacBooks powered by fuel cells.
Yes.
Which, I mean, there's definitely challenges to that. This is just a patent, which, you know, it's just basically the idea. But, you know, the some of the challenges they're going to deal with is, for one, fuel cells are huge. They got to fit those into little tiny laptops. So there's some challenges to beat. But if it does, they're talking about the difference of a laptop lasting you, what, maybe 3 hours, 4 hours? I guess with their newer batteries, they boast 7 hours, which, you know, I'm guessing is reality is six.
Or four.
But the, you know, what they're talking about is days, weeks, possibly, depending on the, you know, how much power is being used at that point in time. But much, much longer periods of time of having without having to recharge.
It's exciting. So, I love it.
That's fantastic.
You know, people watch Apple's patent space, of course, because when they do things, they normally patent them first.
Yeah, of course, we're probably not going to see that in 2012. That's more like a 2015, 2020 range. You know,
why do you have to take the love away, Alex? Why?
But like most of the time when we see patents, you know, like things for like the iPad, for example, those patents were showing up, what, almost 5, 10 years ago. Well, 10 years ago, I think, is when there were patents that were kind of perking up that hinted to ideas of what they were going to do, but, you know, it's vague enough that you really couldn't be sure.
Right.
So we'll see it sometime down the line, and it'll be nice to have systems that can last that long. And I'm sure, you know, with technology in terms of power consumption and, you know, having more efficient devices and all that, we'll have things that last a long, long time. Like your watch, you put a little battery in it, lasts what, months? That'd be kind of cool to have computers just work.
Of course, yes, I agree. Fuel cells would be very cool. Ben, you've been gone for a while. We just got an astronomical to some degree story. I want to hear some more science story. You got anything about, high particle physics or something like that?
Well, I've got some stuff about black holes, actually. I love black holes. When I'm at a distance from them. So we recently discovered we identified a candidate for what would be the smallest known black hole. So if we're right, if our calculations are correct, and this actually is what we think it is, this will be the very smallest black hole. I love watching the scientific process work. Currently, they believe the black hole is about 16,000 to 56,000 light years away from Earth, which is a pretty big range, but, you know, that's just kind of what happens with science. But it's pretty small. It's only the size of a couple stars. It's not particularly large. However, we also recently, just about a week and a half ago, discovered what we think are the largest black holes in the universe. Now, I kind of wish radio could have images with it, because they've got a picture of this thing, of the distortion.
You know, Ben, someday we will have that. We'll call it, it'll be like remote vision. It will be like a television. It'll be amazing.
Hey,
but not yet.
That's cool.
Someone is sitting in the squeakiest chair I've ever heard on radio.
That would be me.
Yeah, that'd be bad. What is he, in a beanbag chair or what?
It's like, what would be the worst chair to sit in when I'm on radio?
I'm sitting on a beanbag chair on top of a creaky old wooden wicker chair.
Oh, God.
not quite. I'm kidding.
High class action from KOSP and from Geek Speak for this holiday season.
Squeak.
Well, I couldn't afford a quieter chair, you know? but... This large black, I wish you guys could see this picture. I'll send it over to you guys, and you the listeners, you can all put it up on, okay. We'll see it on geekspeak.org. But there are all these stars, and then there's kind of this blurry circle of stars where they're getting distorted, and then there's this perfectly round circle, and that's the black hole. Inside of it, there's a little superimposed rectangle, teeny teeny tiny rectangle, and that's our solar system.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
We're about to die then?
this black hole that they're talking about is somewhere around 2,500 times bigger than the black hole in the middle of our Milky Way galaxy.
That's a big black hole.
It is big.
Thanks, Ben, for the black hole update. I appreciate it.
It's fantastic.
There's no way to cleanly segue away from that story. But to hear this next story, so I won't do it cleanly. What's going on in Canada?
I love the meta dialogue.
Isn't it?
Well, in Canada, well, actually, it's one of the things is with the U.S., the USDA has actually approved human trials for an AIDS vaccine, which is big news in the medical. I mean, obviously, I'm not the most well-versed in medicine, but I think this is huge news because they're finally able to actually go forward with testing, which means that they must be fairly close. They must have proven quite a bit.
Sure.
And obviously, of course, proven safety too, to enough that the USDA is saying, yes, you can do this on people. It'd be huge if they are in the very near term come out with an actual HIV or AIDS vaccine to help combat that disease. It's very good news to hear that they're beginning human trials and that's been approved.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's wonderful. So,
you just imagine how many people that would affect. I mean, just Africa alone, it's just a really bad problem there.
You know, it's so frustrating because in this, the first thing I think of is, yeah, that would be great if we had the vaccine. Now, will people actually give it to their kids, right?
Yeah.
If only people would do that. Right?
True.
It's a little
my mommy instinct says no.
Yeah. I mean, anyway. HPV, for example, right? We can get rid of HPV effectively if everyone gets gets immunized for HPV. And, recently, it's been known for a while that HPV is a cause for cervical cancer. And so getting your children before they are of, sexual age, getting them a vaccine for HPV means that they won't get HPV effectively, lower percentage chance, much lower percentage chance, and therefore they're less likely to get cervical cancer. So, give it to girls when they're young enough before they enter into a sexual realm, because after you get the disease, it doesn't help you to get the vaccine for it. And then recently, in the last, month, they're talking about HPV actually causing, in the throat, causing throat cancers, which also, if you got the HPV vaccine, you wouldn't get it, therefore you'd have less throat cancer. So it's like continually give it to your children. It should be in a normal setup. But of course, there's a lot of vaccine fighting, saying vaccines aren't good. The clinical studies say that they're good. They're something we should do as a society. And so now if we'd have an HIV one, of course, will people give it to their kids? I mean, anyway, thank you for the story. I hope that it moves forward and that we actually get a working vaccine for for AIDS or human deficiency syndrome. Okay, let's move on though to Chrome. Yeah, why not, Ben? You know, yes. I normally try to do some segues. I'm just not this week. You can't move from vaccine to Chrome. Chrome, of course, mm-hmm. is a web browser made by Google, which is awesome.
It is fantastic. And thank goodness, Chrome 15 has overtaken IE8 for the top browser spot. So Chrome 15 is the most used browser. That's fantastic. And that is that's in the world, by the way. Now, that's not to say Internet Explorer is it's going downhill, but Internet Explorer is actually quite used if you add up all of the versions of Internet Explorer. Of course, one of the biggest problems is that Internet Explorer users, especially IE6 especially, also 7 and 8, a lot of them don't upgrade for, you know, various reasons. There's no auto upgrade, I believe. And then also companies, it's very expensive to change any piece of software, right? But that kind of prompted me to look at the worst browser, which is IE6. And that's the one that web developers all over the world are waiting for it to disappear. So I looked up statistics. Actually, Microsoft is publicly being pretty insulting towards IE6. They are aware that it needs to go away, and they're actually pushing it to go away. 7 and 8, not as much, unfortunately. But they have a website called IE6countdown.com, and that lists browser stats. And it turns out that, does anyone want to guess the lowest percentage of users, which country?
Oh, that
use IE6?
Which country? China?
China is the highest percentage. China is 27.9% of their users use
Germany.
IE6.
Oh, sorry, you're asking for lowest.
Yeah,
I'll go with Germany.
So China, they have a long way to go. Not Germany, according to this, and of course this doesn't show every country, so I'm assuming they're showing the lowest. Norway. Yeah. 0.2%.
Do they have computers in Norway?
I think they have
that's percentage use, of course.
Percentage use, yes. The United States were right around 1%. So actually, that's better than I thought we were doing with IE6. That's pretty good, 1%. But, you know, still 1 out of 100. That's kind of a lot of people using a web browser that was released in, what was it, 1999 or 2000?
I don't know, sometime before you were born.
Yeah, it was... Thank you. Yeah, GeekSpeak was also started before I was born, right?
All right. Okay, since exactly. You just mentioned Norway, let's do another story on Norway. Alex?
Sure.
Nice.
Norway has actually come up with a cooling system for some of their larger data centers that actually pulls the water from the fjords in the area, or from the adjacent fjords.
Not a solution everyone could do.
Yeah. Well, actually, a lot of data centers are looking at alternative ways of cooling down to cut down on energy, using the cooling mechanisms that are out there in nature. I mean, the water that comes in, the supply that they get, runs at about 46 degrees Fahrenheit, which is exactly what they need to kind of cool down the data center and counter the heat from all the servers. And they're able to just kind of feed it in and then feed it back out. And there's a bit of a warming effect, I'm sure, on the environment itself, which they hopefully have looked at and understand the impact for. But it's kind of cool to see just using nature to cool things down rather than going in spending all, you know, creating all this other energy that causes all sorts of other issues. My guess is this is a lot less impact on the environment than, you know, running some nuclear power plant or something like that.
So if Ford is a long, kind of narrow, steep-sided, with cliffs, valley, carved by a glacier, which then gets blocked at some end, and I don't know if Ford has to be landlocked or not.
I don't believe it does. I think some of them that actually are out there in just north of us up in Canada, just north of Vancouver, there's some fjords up there. And those are, the one side is separated from the other. You actually cruise all the way through.
Right, right. So you can get through it and such. But the point of it is it's extremely narrow and it's extremely deep. And because of that, there's not a lot of turbulence that occurs that mixes the water. So you get very cold water down low. It's a cool way of getting cool water. It freaks me out a little bit of heating it up, but I know that that's a much more effective use of energy conservation and such than creating electricity to produce air conditioning to then lower the temperature of the room. You know,
right.
Even though there's a side effect that you're warming water that's in a Ford, you probably are taking the water out of it, pumping it out. And of course, we're talking about a lot of water. And of course, that's probably a lot better than burning the fossil fuels necessary to make the electricity. So it sounds like a green tech to me. Very cool.
Yep.
Okay. Ben, you're here and I like science. So let's talk about the LHC, shall we?
We shall. I just have kind of a goofy story. This guy, I cannot pronounce his name. Mehlhassa is his last name. He's a teacher, and he produced a Lego. I almost said a working Lego. A Lego model of the LHC collider. So that's the particle accelerator, right? I don't think it would be a working model, right? But it's a 1-to-50 scale model of it using Lego bricks, and it's pretty awesome, actually. 9,500 bricks. That's a lot of Legos. And we all know how expensive Legos are. It cost him about 2,000 euro. That's a lot of money, $2,500. But yeah, I'll put the pictures up on GeekSpeak and everything. He worked on it with his students. It took him 81 hours. He actually designed, he spent more time designing the model of it on his laptop. I wonder if he was using the online Lego builder thing that they give you.
The virtual Lego builder.
Yeah. That's actually pretty cool because then you can order the parts and everything.
To be clear, the Lego company, you go online, you can start building with all these virtual tools, a 3D model of what you want. And then you can say order and they'll actually grab all those pieces and send them to you with the instruction manual, you know, with the instructions on how to build it. Pretty amazing. Expensive, but very cool. I've been doing a lot of Lego stuff lately. Because, you know, it's Christmas time and I've got three kids and Legos are awesome. The other thing I've been doing a lot of is seeing all the different people that are coming to town. Like, I happen to be in the town that I went to high school in. And so I'm spending time on Facebook seeing these people I haven't seen for a while coming and visiting families. And why do they have kids? We get them together. It's been pretty awesome. Alex, what's your next story?
Well, let's talk a little bit about Facebook for a bit. I mean, I haven't heard any stories come out of GeekSpeak about Facebook in, I don't know, a week. One question that I personally have thought of, and you know, it's neat to see this article about this, is how is Facebook affecting school reunions? So, I mean, I'm not sure when your last reunion was, Lyle, but I'm guessing it was probably just the last few years, right? And mine, my 20 year is coming up next year.
Oh, mine
so
too.
The question is, how many people are going to actually show because they are always in touch with the people that they wanted to be in touch with anyway? I know on Facebook, I've got a ton of friends that I haven't seen in years, some of which I may have seen more recently because of Facebook. So it's kind of, there's an impact that Facebook is having on actual attendance at these school reunions. And it's curious to see what happens down the line as social media kind of increases increases communication with people over the years. Will school reunions, like high school reunions, become almost a thing of the past?
Oh, you mean because they won't have to get together to get to figure things out?
See, exactly. I imagine they're always in touch. What do you do when you go to a reunion?
And you already know what the kids look like.
So what have you been up for the last 10 years? Well, it's like, well, what have you been up for the last 10 days? Because you already know what they're all doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you hear about I don't have a lot of information about the story, but the credit card recently, Facebook recently started giving out a reward to people that find security bugs in their system. And they actually send a white hat credit card that has money on it to the person that found the bug. And then they put a certain amount of money on it. And the credit card actually says white hat, security, Facebook security endeavors or something like that. You heard about that, Alex?
No, I haven't.
It's kind of your alley. It's kind of a cool idea. Yeah, they're actually paying people outside of the company to look for security bugs and find them. And, of course, it's a great way if you can motivate a lot of people to do something for you like security. It's a great way to improve your systems.
Yeah, the trend itself is not unique. A lot of companies have started paying for unique bugs that are found in their system to be reported to them, to the company, so that way they at least have time to patch it instead of people selling it to the other side to sell, vulnerabilities to this software or this system or this website. such that it could be used for stealing, fraud, whatever. You know, there has always been a revenue stream coming from the bad guys. It's been in the last few years we've started seeing offers of rewards, and which effectively is a revenue stream for people who find these security bugs to report them to the good guys rather than to the bad guys. So it's kind of almost a competition for, you know, for that this knowledge and keeping the knowledge on the side that results in less fraud and less damage to the companies and the websites and the consumers.
Yeah, it's very cool. Ben, what's going on with AT&T?
I got a pretty fantastic mention. So AT&T has been trying to acquire T-Mobile for, I don't know, the last 4 months or something like that. For a lot of money, $39 billion to acquire T-Mobile, which would put their network, make their network, I think, larger than Verizon's by quite a bit, and would also be horrible for the world in every way possible. So luckily, not luckily, I suppose, after all of the probing, like legal probing and inquiring and everything about anti-monopolistic things and stuff by the Federal Communications Commission, on Monday, AT&T announced that it is done trying to buy T-Mobile from Deutsche Telekom, which is fantastic. Fantastic, fantastic. So
fantastic T-Mobile, because it won't see a larger merge. AT&T doesn't become a larger monopoly.
That, and also personally, because I moved away from AT&T to T-Mobile. I don't want to see another singular AT&T, singular AT&T thing, you know, like where you're with Singular and suddenly you're with AT&T again, you know, like they just keep coming back. So, great.
Thank you for the story. We might have time for one more mention from Alex about electronics. GeekSpeak on QSP is supported by the Monterey Fire Safe Council, promoting projects that help make homes, neighborhoods, and communities throughout Monterey County fire safe through management of natural and man-made resources. Online at firesafemonterey.org. Toastmasters is your local public speaking club, providing a fun, casual, and safe environment to overcome fears of public speaking and to improve speaking skills. Toastmasters meets Monday evening from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Live Oak Senior Center, 1777A Capitol Road in Santa Cruz. Details are available at 234-9713. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Currently, geekspeak.org is also online. We're looking for a new home. If you want to help us out with virtual space, we'd love to talk with you. You can contact us currently at geekspeak.org, as well as find out all about our show. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We thank the Puppet Master for its use. Ben Jaffe, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And Alex Lias, thank you so much also as well for being here.
Thank you very much, Lyle.
Unfortunately, there's only 20 seconds left until NPR comes on. So, Car Talk comes on. So we won't be able to get back to your next story about electronics, but we'll post it up at geekspeak.org, right?
Definitely, because the Terminator stuff is cool.
Terminator stuff is very cool. Merry Christmas, you guys.
Merry Christmas.
Talk to you soon.